It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear about a new and interesting collection in the University of Wisconsin that the University of Wisconsin recently acquired and what it could possibly teach us about the Earth's ecosystems.
First, a business group in Milwaukee is floating a proposal that could lead to more funding for arts and cultural institutions in the area.
The Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce is exploring the possibility of one or more referenda in the counties around Milwaukee. The question at hand for these voters, would they be willing to support a sales tax increase to address the region's arts and cultural needs? Nothing set in stone yet, but it raises some interesting questions for the area, and we'll ask you to chime in on the broader question, would you be willing to pay some more in sales tax to support the arts in your community? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now to talk about the proposal and the overall arts funding picture in the state is Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin. Ann, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
Well, Ann, let's be clear. You're not involved with the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce that is floating this idea, but you're at the forefront over the fight for arts funding here in Wisconsin. So with that said, can you tell us about the proposal, what it's thinking about?
Well, as you said, I haven't been involved in the development of this. I think I know some people who have been, but you know, everyone is looking for looking to diversify funding for arts and culture, quality of life, education, all of the issues, you know, that sort of surround us every day. The economy is changing. That means the funding structure is changing, especially in the sort of quality of life arena, and sales tax devoted to specific issues like arts and culture has worked in other communities, most famously Denver. This is actually an idea that has been talked about for a long time, I think. I know that there have been some meetings maybe over the last 10 years to talk about this kind of taxing issue, but it seems to be reborn now, and the business community is obviously interested in looking at it. And I think it's an idea worth exploring.
Now, as you said, this is a business group that is floating this idea for possible referenda. It's not an arts group that's looking into it. Is that significant?
Well, it's great, actually. And, you know, everybody's involved in the arts now. I guess I'll say that. The whole issue of quality of life, arts and culture, creativity as assets for the community is one that's very much growing in Wisconsin. And Milwaukee, in a lot of ways, is a very good example of how the arts and culture are transforming the community. Business development is not only looking at the tax breaks or usual or older economic development techniques that have been in place over the last 50 years of the old economy, but they're looking for new ways to brand and enhance their community as a good place to live, work, learn, and play. So it is extremely appropriate and really a great step forward, I think, that the business community is thinking about how do we invest in our artistic and creative infrastructure so that we can grow our economy, educate our kids, keep our communities healthy, and benefit our residents. So it's very much an idea whose time has come.
Let's take a caller now, and you can chime in as well on the answer to the question, would you be willing to pay a bit more in sales tax to support the arts in your community? Our number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we go now to Adam in Madison. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I 100% support some type of small tax increase, as long as it's obviously not outrageous. But it's just sad how education, in particular the arts, have been cut in recent years. And not just Milwaukee, you know, but everywhere. Because it seems, you know, arts are, you know, always the things to go. That physical education in schools. But there is so many aspects. Arts are a huge part of our society that need to be sustained. And in my opinion, increased creativity is a huge part about, you know, our makes us human. So I think it's a very important thing that we need to keep, you know, keep investing in going forward.
Okay, thank you for your thoughts, Adam. Appreciate that. And what do you say to that, Ann Katz?
Well, I think Adam is singing my song for sure. You know, I think that the people of Wisconsin are seeing that we want to keep our infrastructure. We want everyone to benefit from the many wonderful resources, creative and otherwise, that we have. And as the, you know, again, as the economy changes, as the role of government, perhaps, or the whole funding structure to keep this infrastructure strong is changing, then we have to find new ideas. And I think the people of Wisconsin really want that to keep going. I'll say that the voters in the Denver area have voted 3 times to tax themselves to support everything from the arts to zoos. They've had a regional creative tax in place for at least 10 years. And the voters have ratified it 3 times. So, you know, this is not a tax for tax's sake. This is an investment in the future. And I think that, you know, it seems like they're, as I said, it's an idea worth exploring.
And the Milwaukee County Zoo is one that could potentially benefit from this should all aspects go forward. So there's some similarities there. But not everyone agrees with Adam on this one. Some people see funding, public funding of the arts, as something that's not quite as necessary maybe as some other things, more pressing priorities. What's the case you would make that arts funding is worthwhile to a city and all the people who live there?
Well, I'd say that that the arts are critical to the health and well-being of everyone in Wisconsin, if you're looking at the state. I mean, certainly in Milwaukee and everyone in the state, because the priorities of the arts are the priorities of the state. We're not talking about the arts for only a few people. We're talking about creative expression, growing the economy for the 21st century, educating our kids for the 21st century, because all of our kids, whether they're in the arts or not, need to be critical thinkers and problem solvers, and those are the skills that the arts teach. We want our communities to be healthy and good places to live, and we want to be connected to our neighbors and our community members. So that's what the arts are about. It's not something that's separate from our lives. The arts are a part of everyone's lives in Wisconsin. And so people might say we don't want arts funding, but our message very much is, this is not about funding something for just a few people. This is about funding helping everyone benefit, whether they call themselves an artist or whether they're in the arts or not. So we're very much, you know, that's the message we're promoting. We see a lot of understanding and interest in that message and that reality. And so I certainly understand that there are people that might disagree, but we're just going to keep educating as we go along.
Now, on the economic side of things, the economy seems to be in recovery, but it hasn't made the complete turnaround yet. Is this, do you think, the time to consider raising taxes when people may be strapped? It's just a modest increase we're talking about here, 0.5% or 1% maybe, and this is all very theoretical at this point, but are people still stretched too thin?
Well, I think we all, there's no doubt that we are all stretched too thin. I run a nonprofit organization. I totally understand being stretched too thin. But I think what I've also been seeing with, people in the community and leaders alike is that there's a realization that this is not the recession ending. This is the beginning of a new economy. And Wisconsin will continue to be a manufacturing and agricultural state, of course, but we're also going to be much more focused on small businesses, creative businesses, and quality of life as part of the economic picture. And so in the short term, people might be feeling a little stretched thin, but this is a long-term thing. This tax isn't going to happen tomorrow, first of all. There's a lot of development that has to go on before it would become a reality. Everything needs to be put in place in a right way, and the voters do have to vote on it. But I think that the case can be made that in the bigger picture, in the long term, this would be a good investment for the health and well-being of the community. And I think that's the message that needs to be out there.
Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Anne. Take care.
That was Anne Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, find out why quitting your job now might mean bigger payoffs later in your career.
First, the UW-Madison is home to a lot of collections. There's art, tons of books, scientific samples of all kinds. Now you can add another collection to that list, and it's one of the biggest collections of its kind in the world.
The Wisconsin State Herbarium recently acquired a massive collection of rare lichen specimens, about 60,000 of them, to be exact. Okay, so cool, you might think, but so what? Well, according to our next guest, there's plenty of reasons to be excited about the humble lichen, and there's a lot they can teach us about the world's ecosystems, too.
Joining us now to talk about the collection is Ken Cameron. He's a professor of botany at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. Ken, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, we're going to have to get our terminology correct here. Lichen 101, what are lichen and where do they come from?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm glad that you're pronouncing it correctly. It's spelled L-I-C-H-E-N, but it's pronounced lichen. And lichens are a symbiotic relationship between algae and fungi. It turns out, in fact, that they may even have bacteria living amongst them, creating their own sort of micro ecology or community. I'm sure you've seen them, the crusty green or white or even yellow or orange crusts and spots that you see on rocks and tree bark, even growing on your roof tiles, are lichens.
So in a way, lichens are kind of ecosystems in and of themselves, since they've got these different species kingdoms actually represented.
Exactly. They're very hard to classify, and obviously they don't reproduce because they are a composite of different kingdoms of life living in harmony and in symbiosis. And that ability actually allows them to exist in parts of the world where other organisms are incapable of living, such as high up in the Arctic Circle.
Now, this particular collection that came the way of UW-Madison, tell us about it and why it's significant.
Sure. Well, we've always had a large focus on lichenology at UW-Madison. Our herbarium is about 1.2 million specimens in size, of which about 120,000 are lichens. That puts us among the top maybe three lichen collections in the Western Hemisphere. And so those have always been an important part of our collection. Recently, this collection by a German professor named Klaus Kalb went up on the auction block. And again, as you said, 60,000 specimens, that's a really nice chunk of specimens to add to our collection. And fortunately, we have an endowment in place to acquire collections like that, and we jumped at the chance.
And so with these new 60,000, are we among the biggest collections in the world now?
Yeah, we sure are. We're estimating now approximately 180,000 lichens in our holdings. And I have to admit that these are still uncatalogued. They're in the same cardboard boxes that we shipped over from Germany. Took a lot of work to get that collection over here through customs. But the really exciting thing is that this collection from Klaus Kalb includes a lot of tropical species from parts of the Old World, whereas our traditional focus has been on temperate zone and the Arctic in particular. So now we estimate that with this addition, we may actually have at least one of every species of lichen from about 70% of all known lichens on Earth.
Now, you are someone who is really excited by and obviously fascinated by lichen. Share that with us. Why should we care about them and what they have to offer the scientific world?
Well, I'll admit to you that I'm not a lichenologist. I actually study orchids, just about the most opposite that you could think of from a lichen. Although that's not entirely true because orchids, you may know, also form symbiotic relationships with fungi. So this theme of the interconnectivity of life and the great web of life on Earth is becoming more and more known and appreciated. Lichens have been overlooked and I think underappreciated, but their role as environmental indicators, tracking climate change, they've been used almost like a canary in a coal mine for air pollution studies. And so they really are very important to our entire ecosystem function.
Yeah, let's get into that a little more. How have lichens been used as part of the detective work in tracking things like the environment? And I understand even radiation spread throughout the world.
Yeah, exactly. I moved here to Madison about 7 years ago from New York City. And lichens played a very important role in monitoring air quality in New York City, particularly in Central Park. We knew that lichens had grown there for centuries. They're well documented. And before the Clean Air Act, lichens started disappearing, and people were very concerned about them. They were used then to track the improvement in air quality in New York and other major urban centers. You mentioned radioactivity and its fallout. That's true. Any radioactivity in the atmosphere that is going to precipitate out, along with other heavy metals and pollutants, are absorbed by lichens. And so those can be documented. One troubling thing is that caribou and reindeer herds actually feed on lichens in the Arctic. And any hunters, any humans who then hunt those reindeer or caribou as their food source are ingesting those pollutants and toxins.
Now, if we look at some possibilities for blue sky research on lichens, things that might be potentials way down the road, what are some things that lichen could potentially teach us or do for the world and humankind?
Well, that's a really great question. Again, this notion of how organisms intercommunicate with each other, these symbioses, that's something that lichens can serve as a model for genetic signaling between unrelated organisms. We have a new colleague joining our botany staff soon. She's a mycologist who studies fungi, and she actually commented to me that she believes lichens are actually immortal, that they never die, and how many organisms on Earth can we claim to have immortality? Another exciting avenue of research, one of my colleagues in botany, he's a retired lichenologist named Jim Bennett. He has recently documented that some lichens may actually show characteristics to prevent chronic wasting disease, which you know is affecting the deer herds and populations here in Wisconsin.
So we could have maybe some kind of equivalent of an animal public health intervention with lichen in, say, a CWD zone in the States? I mean, this is looking ahead here.
That's pretty hypothetical, but it's exciting, and I think that research is in its infancy. But at this point in time, you know, any sort of antidote or cure is worth pursuing. So, again, lichens have been overlooked, but they might have a lot of great potential for medical and environmental and evolutionary studies.
So the UW seems to be a good home for lichen, seems to be a bit of a history here. What can you tell us about the UW's current situation with lichen and why this was a good place for these thousands of lichen to end up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess the good news and the bad news there is the good news is we do have a long track record. A former professor who passed away a few years ago, Dr. John Thompson, was considered one of the world authorities on lichens. He wrote several books, particularly focused on Arctic lichens of the New World, and as well as the lichens of Wisconsin, which we still sell a lot of copies of that book. Your listeners can write to me at the herbarium if they'd like a copy. After his passing, we no longer had a permanent lichenologist on the university staff, but fortunately there are a number of retired lichenologists and dedicated volunteers working in the herbarium on a daily basis, and they're keeping that tradition alive. I should also add that the National Science Foundation just funded a four-year project to digitize all North American lichen specimens from all museums across the country. And UW-Madison, under the supervision of Dr. Tom Nash, one of our volunteers, is actually leading that national effort.
Now, at the herbarium, can we in the public go and see some of the samples, whether it's lichen or your orchids or anything like that, or is this a research-only environment?
We are primarily a research organization. We're not a museum with displays or exhibits, but we are a state agency. In fact, our herbarium, I like to remind people, is in the top 1% of the world's largest herbaria. But more excitingly, we're the third largest public university herbarium in all of the Western Hemisphere. And as a public institution, we're committed to research and to engagement with the public. So we're open daily, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, or by appointment if people would like to come outside of those hours. And myself or any one of our curators would be glad to give you a tour of our not only lichen collections, but our fungal collections, our algae, and more probably most people's interest, the plant collections.
So you've got these thousands of lichens sitting around at the herbarium in boxes. What needs to happen next? What do you need to do?
Well, as I mentioned, they need to be cataloged, so we need to unpack them. Fortunately, Professor Kalb, the German lichenologist whom we bought these from, is very meticulous. So I don't expect that we're going to need to do a whole lot of processing, but we are expanding our footprint within historic Burge Hall at the top of Bascom Hill. We're acquiring space that was formerly occupied by the biology library. And we're setting up new cabinets. We're trying to get the space reorganized. And this is going to really give us the much-needed space to expand this really unparalleled world-class collection.
And I imagine this is an opportunity for students, undergraduates and graduates, to study a pretty unparalleled collection in the country, in the world.
Yeah, the kids get really excited about it. We bring in a lot of work-study students. We support a lot of students through our volunteer and pay. I teach general botany, so every semester, the 200 kids in my class, I ask if there's anyone interested in volunteering or working in the herbarium. Gosh, right now we probably have about 12 undergraduates who are employed regularly in the herbarium helping us process these collections and getting them exposed to the importance of the collections and their curation, I think is really important.
And Ken, very briefly, is there any other lichen part that you're hoping to add to your collection one day?
Well, we're always keeping our eye out. We fortunately do have this endowment fund that I mentioned. We keep it in reserve until just the right time when the perfect collection comes up for sale, and we're happy that we're able to do that through the generosity of Esther and Oscar Allen.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
We've been speaking with Ken Cameron, director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. He joined us to talk about the UW-Madison's recent acquisition of about 60,000 rare species of lichen.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For our parents and grandparents, it was common to hang on to the same job or stick with the same company for almost an entire career. So-called job hopping was frowned upon.
Today, the career landscape is different. And according to our next guest, job hopping might actually be good for your career, especially if you're younger.
Derek Thompson is here to explain. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, and he recently wrote a piece called Quit Your Job: The Surprising Benefits of Taking Your 20s to Use the Labor Market as a Laboratory. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
So to jump around like that from job to job, especially early on, doesn't seem like the way you would traditionally be counseled to begin your career, but a new study has a different take on this. Why could job jumping be beneficial?
Right. It seems completely irresponsible to quit all these jobs in your 20s. It seems like you don't know what you're doing, like you're wayward and completely lost. But it turns out that the people who are truly lost in the labor force, truly lost on the job, tend to be those who enter a job that they don't like and just stay there. And they just stay there disliking what they do on an hour-to-hour basis and never find their true calling. It turns out, these economists said, that young people that use the labor market like a lab, use it to sort of experiment with jobs and say, I'll try this for a few months, maybe a year, 2 years, but if I don't like it, I'm not going to feel shackled to it. These are the kind of people who are not only more likely to find something that they truly love in their 30s or 40s, they're also more likely to make more money. And perhaps they're more likely to make more money precisely because they're more productive in a job they end up in that they actually like.
I don't know if we have the data on this yet, but is this primarily advice that is for the young and the people who are, say, in their 30s, 40s, 50s? If they hear you talking and say, I'm going to start job hopping now, is it really ill-advised later on?
This is such an important question. This was a study looking at quit rates among young people, looking at quit rates among people in their 20s. And so this is not to say that if you are 37 years old or 45 years old and taking care of a family, that it is always and every single time prudent to quit your job. That is not what the economists were saying. What they were doing was simply showing a correlation between numbers of quits of people in their 20s and higher earnings later in their life. So if you are 30 or 40, then perhaps you can use this advice to counsel your younger friends, but do not go about quitting your job quite so quickly. And the reason why this information, this piece of advice, does not port over well into middle age is that young people tend to make the least amount of money. And a silver lining to making very little money is that the opportunity cost of quitting that job is very low because the wage isn't that high. Once the wage gets considerably high, the opportunity cost of quitting is immense, particularly when you're the breadwinner for a family of three or four. So this is, as you said, very important to point out, advice for people who are younger, not advice for middle-aged breadwinners.
So the common wisdom used to be that, you know, if you're hopping around a lot, you're going to apply for a job and the hiring committee, whoever's making those decisions, says this person's a little flaky. They're not staying a long time. It demonstrates some qualities I'm concerned about. Apparently, that's not being read that way anymore.
One thing that was really interesting when I talked to these economists is that there is an impression that I get from HR people around the country that young people today are more likely to quit their job. In other words, this is a way for corporations to not invest that much in young workers, not try to train them, not pay them that much, not give them tremendous benefits or an enormous break, because they expect these people to quit rather quickly. It turns out from the data that millennials, people born between 1982 and 2000, the youngest generation in the workforce today, actually is not that much more likely to quit than previous generations. The quit rate has not changed dramatically, particularly in good economic times. Here's what has changed. What's changed is that when people quit jobs today, they're more likely to take another job in an entirely different occupation. They're not as likely to quit, say, being a secretary for a chemical company and then become a secretary for a media publishing company. They're more likely to quit that secretary job and then try their hand at something completely different. Maybe it's software engineering, or maybe it's a marketing job. So what you see in the upshot is that quit rates are not growing over time. The HR people that I've talked to, their experience is not borne out in the data. But once people have quit, they're more likely to try something totally different, to essentially use the labor market like a laboratory.
Right. So when millennials, sounds like, are doing this job hopping thing right, what they're doing is treating the job market sort of like a buffet and just sampling all kinds of different things to get to the thing that's the best fit.
Right. And it should be said that this is easier said sitting in a chair than it is done. It's very difficult, particularly in the last few years, to find a job, much less a great job, much less a job that you consider your true calling, your dream job. And quitting also has all sorts of emotional and financial costs. You are potentially giving up a good amount of money. You're giving up the social relationships that you had. There are fears about burning bridges at these companies, which I frankly think are overblown, because there are just so many companies that burning bridges at one, even when you leave it, it shouldn't be that important. What I'm saying is a little more subtle than that. It's that I think that there is a tremendous fear, a great conservatism among young people when they have a job, particularly now that the labor market is getting a little bit better, to say, I'm going to hold on to this. I'm not going to explore. It's too costly. It's too risky. And what these economists are saying is that as we're approaching normalcy in this economy, and we are approaching it however slow, people should feel a little less conservative, a little more wacky about looking at that job that they consider their dream job and potentially going after it. Because it turns out that when we find the thing that we love to do and are productive at it and stay at it and work at it, that's where the higher wage comes.
Was this something that was counterintuitive to you? As you know, I think you contrasted yourself with your roommate. You were sort of saying slow and steady wins the race. You stick around, it'll get better. Right. But I mean, is this something that some of us are going to have to flip around in our heads a little bit?
I think absolutely. I think people are by nature risk averse, particularly when it comes to a weak economy. And I think a lot of these young people who graduated into the Great Recession, there's all sorts of studies that show that the attitudes that you have between, say, 15 and 25 tend to be attitudes that you port with you for the rest of your life. I think that you have there's a certain risk averseness that comes when you are working in a really weak economy, when anybody, it seems, can be fired, when jobs are so hard to get. But the economy is going to get better, you know, God willing. And so when it is better, people should be more willing to experiment. They should be, you know, less risk averse. And so, you know, I don't follow my own advice or hadn't before I read this story. When my close friends, you know, told me that they hated their job and me and my roommate were sort of sitting on the couch sort of counseling them like it was career therapy, I would always be that angel on the left shoulder saying, please stay at the job. You know, you can experiment a little bit, but happiness comes with mastery. Keep working at it. And it was my roommate, the devil on the other shoulder, who was saying, you need to get out of there. You need to look as hard as possible for another job, because that's what's going to make you happy. And, you know, work is 40, 50, 60 hours a week. You do not want to be miserable for half of your lifetime.
Now, in terms of the benefits you mentioned earlier, that the increased job satisfaction, the increased earnings, are we sure that these benefits correlate to sampling more of the job market? Or is it could be that the people who are less risk averse are risk takers and those risks may pay off down the road?
It's a fabulous point. You know, correlation is not causation, as every single commenter in one of my articles reminds me over and over when I make one of these correlations and perhaps suggest it's a causation. You're right. There is an alternative explanation, which is that people who are more risky and more aggressive and know themselves better, are more in tune with what they're really good at, are A, more likely to quit a job that doesn't fit what they know is good for them, and B, more likely to earn more later precisely because they're more aggressive. So this is, you know, what an academic might call a third-party variable. It's not that if you quit a lot, you'll get richer. It's if you're more aggressive, then you'll quit a lot and get richer. We can't say that that's not what's happening. So what I wanted to do was simply to point out the correlation to maybe get people to think a little bit more creatively about finding a dream job, knowing that the data, when widely looked at, does suggest that holding out until you find your true calling not only has emotional rewards, but also financial.
We're talking right now with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, about why it might be a good idea to quit your job, sample what's out there in the labor market, try on different jobs, especially, it sounds like, if you are in your 20s, if you're a millennial.
And what about you? Share your thoughts and your experiences. Does this make sense to you, or does it sound like a bad idea? If you're established in your career, looking back, did you jump around a lot so you found the right thing or stick with what you started with? Was that the right call, or do you wish you'd done it the other way? Are you a young person and weighing a decision about whether to stay in your job? Let us know what's going through your head. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and take your calls after this check of the headlines with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with Derek Thompson from The Atlantic Magazine about whether quitting your job might actually be a wise career move, especially if you are in your 20s, mainly if you're in your 20s and you're in the younger end of the job market, that you can sample things, try it on, seems to correlate with higher wages and greater job satisfaction.
And we want to hear from you wherever you are in your career now. Did you at some point make a job switch that paid off in the end, or did you wish you'd stuck with it? If you could give career advice to younger workers, would quit your job, shop around, be among the tips? If you're an employer, what do you make of younger workers who have bounced around from a bunch of different jobs? Good experience or flaky? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our first caller now. Taylor joins us in Janesville. Hi, Taylor.
Hi.
What do you think of this?
Well, as far as, you know, career choices go for me, I'm 23 years old. I bounced around a little bit. I was a waiter at the Cracker Barrel. I went to college for a year and a half right out of high school, and it just didn't really have a whole lot of direction for me. I didn't know what to do. It wasn't working out for me. I made a geographical change after that. And then I decided to go to school to be a commercial diver. Took classes down in Jacksonville, Florida at the academy. I ended up getting a job out in Louisiana after that. Worked in the Gulf of Mexico for the oil industry as a diver for about a year. And I just got real tired of it. Just wasn't for me. It didn't feel right. So came back up to Wisconsin on a whim. I quit my job because I wasn't happy. And without a job, I searched around for another dive job up in the Great Lakes. I found one, and it lasted for about 3 months. It just didn't feel right. I was traveling. I had met someone, and it wasn't making me happy yet again, so I made another change. Now I'm a carpenter, a union carpenter in Madison, and that's what I'm doing right now, and I'm still looking for the right thing.
All right, so you're still bouncing, it sounds like. Are you happy that you made all of those transitions, different cities, different states, different jobs? Has it made you a better person, giving you a better sense of what you like?
Yeah, I think it's made me more independent. I've struggled throughout all the moves, and I've learned how to save my money, because I've kind of started to realize that what's out there for me hasn't necessarily been achieved yet, and so I'm trying to prepare for that opportunity once it comes out. You know, I've become stronger because of it. I've become smarter. I know that, but I've also realized what it is that I don't like. And that's kind of helped me start to pinpoint what it is that I do really want out of my life.
Thank you so much, Taylor, for sharing your experiences, lots of experiences on Taylor's end there, Derek. And it sounds like there's a cost-benefit ratio going on. He's learned a lot, and he's still learning, but also some struggles making those job hops. Is that typical of how it goes?
Especially in the last few years for young people. I mean, this labor market has not, since 2007, 2008, been a normal labor market. It's been extremely rough, and it's been particularly rough for young people. The unemployment rate, the youth unemployment rate that's between, say, 15 and 24, where it sounds like the caller is from, is typically, you know, two times bigger than the national unemployment rate. It is twice as difficult for young people to find a job that they're settled in. And so I think the most important thing to take away from this, in addition to sort of the macroeconomic stuff, is also it's interesting that he had the wherewithal to know that these jobs weren't fits. There's lots of people, lots of listeners, lots of my friends that I know who they are in jobs and they aren't really sure if it's a job for them or not. And it doesn't take them 1 month, 3 months. It takes them 3 years, 5 years to realize that what they're doing isn't really bringing them joy. And so I think that an aspect of this that is positive is that the feedback loop was really, really fast. He learned very quickly that this wasn't what he wanted to do. And as a result, he could get moving very quickly.
Right. Sounds like the self-knowledge part is really key to having this technique be a successful one for you. Would you agree?
Were you asking me or the caller?
Sorry, Derek.
Oh, yeah, right. I do think that it's very easy, essentially, for status quo bias to take over, for us to feel like because we wake up and you know, look in the same closet and take the same commute and go to the same place day after day, there's a familiarity about that that can be both nice and also numbing. And so it does take, I think, a special kind of self-awareness to know very quickly that something isn't working out. And, you know, that's where I take my hat off. I think it's a lot harder to do than it is to talk about.
Well, thank you so much to Taylor, and good luck to you. And we're going to move on to Bill in Wakefield, Michigan. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Great topic, Derek. I just want to say it's up here in the Northwoods here. Just shovel yourself out. We've been bombarded here with endless amounts of snow, and you pretty much have to be very versatile up here in the UP and wear many hats and be able to do just about anything for an income.
Yes, lots of snow up there, Bill. I know we're hearing about that here. And Derek, are there certain climates where you do have to be versatile? You don't really have the option of just sitting in one job for a long time. Versatility ultimately pays off.
Well, one thing the caller is talking about is part-time work, and part-time work has absolutely been elevated. It is falling significantly slower, actually, than unemployment. So it's been a little sticky. There's been a lot of people who have part-time work and can't quite make the transition to full-time work. And so I do think that it's worth thinking about the possibility that in the next few years in the economy, perhaps in the next few decades, that we're going to have more people, not maybe the majority of people, but more people than we've been used to historically, working not one job with a pension, but a lot of little jobs, a lot of little gigs, and, you know, culling together a life by doing a couple different things. And on the one hand, the downside of that is that you don't have the kind of security and perhaps benefits that we might be used to from the mid-20th century. But on the other hand, if you're doing a lot of things, then maybe you're looking for that one thing that you love, and you're spending, you know, some of your working time doing something you find truly valuable and self-actualizing.
Well, thank you much to Bill for that call, and good luck with the snow up in Michigan. We're going to go next to Dan in Burlington. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What do you think about job hopping?
I don't think it's a detriment to your success in your career. I had to do some job hopping, sometimes not because I wanted to, just because I had to. Either I was miserable in my job, or you just get laid off. So in an effort to stay employed, I would pick up, you know, whatever job was available to me that I had qualifications for. And then upon doing that, I ended up picking up additional skills, and sometimes it wasn't even in a field that I had been in previously. So between being, let's say, a bricklayer, working in manufacturing jobs, as a tech, working in hydraulics, or whether it was electronics, and now I'm working as a network administrator. So each one of those jobs gave me something different that I could use at the next job. So that just basically helped me out. And I happen to be in my 40s. So if young folks need to do that, I think it just broadens the scope of your skills that you can get.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience, Dan. And Dan saying it was a necessity for him, but one that had a silver lining, even though he didn't necessarily choose it. Is that a good way to think about it when these transitions happen, that there are skills that people pick up each time?
I do think that we need to be careful in thinking about part-time work and leaving work that is economically motivated. Somebody wants to work full-time, but they can't, and so they work part-time. They wanted this full-time job, but they were laid off. These are separations from workers and companies, and these are bad, and we've seen a lot of these in the last few years. But that doesn't mean that part-time work and leaving your company is always bad. And I think that in a healthy economy, which, like I said, hopefully we're moving into, you do like to see a little bit of fluidity. You do like to see people leaving their employers and saying, I can get a better deal elsewhere. And it's nice sometimes to see people who say, I want to do this thing because it makes me happy, even though it isn't a full-time job. And so I'm going to tie together a couple different part-time gigs. Maybe, I'll drive a Lyft while I'm an artist and also spend some time working as a barista because I want to find any way to support my art, which is the thing that really gets me up in the morning. These sort of lives, which have for the last few years been inflicted on young people by the recession, in a normal economy are perfectly legitimate and something to root for.
Well, Derek, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
Absolutely.
We've been speaking with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His recent piece is called Quit Your Job, and you can weigh in. Tell us what you think about job hopping. Have you done it? Do you think there are benefits? Have you seen it play out the way Derek has described it may be playing out for people in their 20s right now? You can check in at the Central Time Facebook page.